Welcome to WeAreTechnology.com's User Friendly 2.0 with host Bill Sickens, Technology Architect.
And this is User Friendly 2.0. I'm your host, Bill Sickens. Joining me, Gretchen and Bill, my co-host. Welcome to this week's show.
Hello.
Hello.
So we've got some great stuff coming up for you this week. In this segment, a little bit later, we're going to be going over to a local high school to look at their career fair, which was, in my opinion, amazing. We'll get into that a little bit later. And in our second segment, we have a guest with a great interview, and I'm not going to give any more away. You're just going to have to listen and check that out after we get done with this and get back from our commercial. So check out our website. You can pick all of this up there and the podcast and submit your questions and everything else. Userfriendly.show is the place to go for that. Check it out and let us know what you think. All right, what do we have in the news this week?
U.S. awards Samsung $6.4 billion in grants to boost Texas chip output.
So this is part of the CHIPS Act, and this is we talked about this for Intel a few weeks ago. Again, the idea is to bring microchip manufacturing back to the United States, which is something that I do support. I think that it is important for us to make our own technology domestically, just because a lot's going on in the world right now. But even outside of all of that, during COVID, I think we all learned that if you don't have stuff locally and you can't get things imported,
yep,
it's a problem. And even today, if your bridge falls down, it causes problems getting to the port, you know?
Yeah.
So this is something I think that's going to create a lot of jobs and it's going to put things in the right direction to get some domestic manufacturing. Now, Intel is a U.S.-based company. Samsung is not, but they do their manufacturing here. At least that's what they're supposed to do with the money they're getting based out of South Korea. So it'll be good to see this going on. And it's going to be interesting to see what other companies get a little bit from this windfall.
Cisco Duo warns third-party data breach exposed SMS MFA logs.
All right, so acronym warning here. SMS refers to texting, like sending a text message on your cell phone. Simple messaging service is what that stands for. MFA is multi-factor authentication. So spelling that out, what we have is a situation here where there was a breach with Cisco, and they're warning that the bad actors got into some of the VoIP, VoIP over the internet, and SMS logs. And the reason why this is a big deal is because the multi-factor authentication we use in a lot of cases sends a number or a message of some kind to your phone.
Yeah.
So if the hackers can get in and get to your texts, then they can initiate and completely bypass the security that's created by having that extra level of password. So this kind of a situation is a big deal. And just as a footnote on that, I know everybody says it, but when you do use multi-factor authentication, like you're logging onto your bank account or something, the legitimate companies will never ask you for those codes. So if you're on the phone with the bank, they know who you are. They're able to look it up. If someone does call you and say, hey, there's a problem with your account and we need you to log in and give us the multi-factor authentication code that you get in a text, don't do it. That is a giant red flag. And if they get in, they'll be able to get to your accounts. And in a lot of cases, there's liability issues where some banks will not give you your money back if the bad guy got in because you gave them the SMS code. So just something to be aware of. If it feels off, it is. But no legitimate company should ever ask you for that information, because if you're talking to the legitimate company, they're going to know and be able to pull up who you are anyway. So just, you know, be careful. But this is a big deal. This is something you don't want, but this is something that the bad guys certainly are trying to do.
Widely used PuTTY SSH client found vulnerable to key recovery attack.
All right. So if you're a programmer or work with servers, you're going to know what this is. If you're not, now's a good time to maybe go grab your coffee. When you connect to a server, especially in the Linux world, you use a client that does the security and is compatible with the security protocols being used and all that. And there's a couple of them out there. PuTTY is one that is very widely used, and it's free, which is one of the reasons for that. I know internally we use a different product that you have to buy, but PuTTY does its thing for most people. The only problem with it is if it's vulnerable to an attack like this, bad actors can get in and get the encryption keys that are being used to secure your server. So what's being told to do here is upgrade your software, that kind of a thing. They're patching it, but is definitely something to be wary about. And just be careful again with all these type of things. The bad guys are trying to get in any way they can. And as it's often said, cybersecurity experts, we have 8 to 10 hours a day to work. They have 24 hours a day. It is causing a little bit of a lopsided problem. So just be careful. And just if something feels off, don't do it. Stuff like this, update your software. And because this is a specialty type of program that is usually used by server administrators and that type of thing, I think there's going to be a lot more people updating the way that they're supposed to and being able to correct it than maybe with some other things. But nevertheless, if you don't know about it, you might not know that you need to update.
Porch piracy deterrent creates controversy.
So I got to say, when I first saw this, I found it to be amusing. But the second thing I'm going to preface this with, and I'm not an attorney or anything like that, but if you do this, please contact someone that is to find out if it's legal. Basically, what's going on here is a company has created a thing called the Paint Cam. And what this is a night vision equipped security camera that uses facial recognition. And as they say, deters intruders with paintball markers. In other words, if it decides it doesn't like you, it starts firing paintballs or tear gas at you.
Yeah.
Now, the question that I have to ask here is what could possibly go wrong? You know, but
wait till it doesn't recognize grandma coming up.
Yeah, that's the concern with these type of things. Plus, a lot of jurisdictions do have rules about setting up booby traps. Again, don't know where this would fall legally, but that kind of a thing would be something to be concerned about. Now, it does have a mode where you can turn the automated stuff off and have it ping your phone. You pull up the camera feed, and then you decide to fire the paintball or the tear gas at the porch pirate. Now, again, I don't know if that's legal either, but it's a little less intense than the automatic.
I'd be more likely
function.
To want to turn the sprinklers on, you know?
Yeah, you know, that might be another option, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen, what is it, everything from a glitter bomb to live snakes to basically the equivalency of a Claymore anti-personnel mine.
Oh, wow.
Yep. And it just, people are getting done with it. And I understand that completely. This product's going to go live on Kickstarter next week, the Paint Cam. I have a funny feeling it's going to be funded very quickly. But I do know one of the other things of the catalytic converter theft, and it's just a little bit of a footnote on this, is I was devising a booby trap for my car because this was happening a lot. And I was also given some legal advice on what you can and cannot do. Apparently, it would be illegal to trap the thief under your car and then have it start automatically. That's what I was told.
However, which part, the start automatically or the trap?
probably both. Now, putting a cage around the catalytic converter and taking steps to secure it, totally fine. But, obviously for anybody that doesn't know if the car start, and I'm joking on that, of course, but if the car was to start with someone trapped under there, it would heat up because it's the exhaust system and you can kind of see where that would go.
Ouch.
And catalytic converter theft is not a capital offense. So legitimately, that's not appropriate. But people are getting done with being ripped off all the time. And I think that's where some of these ideas come from, because it's just, the police are overwhelmed. In some jurisdictions, they've been cut back and there's not a lot, everything can't get dealt with. So at the end of the day, it becomes like you do need to be able to look out for your things. But there are rules about that. So you just want to make sure you don't run afoul of that. But again, at the end of the day, I think that the idea here personally is kind of cool. And if it is legal to use it and all of that type of thing, it might be kind of fun to have one of these. My problem is I'm not sure if I just do porch pirates. If someone came up that I didn't want to talk to, I'd certainly have I'd be tempted, right?
Uh-oh. All I can think of is a friend of mine who we ended up calling him Princess after a paintball game because he couldn't stand getting shot with pink paintballs.
Oh, no.
Oh, my goodness.
Anybody that hasn't played paintball, they do sting, especially if you don't have the right kind of protection. And I actually quite like paintball. Haven't done it in a while, but you do feel it and it can bruise and all of that, so.
All right. And our last story is 911 outages reported in 4 states as emergency call services go down temporarily.
Yeah, so this is kind of scary. You know, 911 is an amazing service and they have access to that. It's just assumed that it's going to be there. But this last week in Nebraska, Texas, Nevada, and South Dakota, anybody calling 911 in some of those areas found that it would not work. And 911 outages do happen. I mean, it's not something that is completely unheard of, but it is quite scary when they do, because access to emergency services in many ways are cut off. So one of the things that I would advise having is the actual phone number of your emergency services. So a way to dial a 7-digit number to the police, fire department, medical, that kind of thing. So if you can't, for some reason, get through on 911, then you would have a backup. They're not going to answer as quickly, but at least it would be some way to get help. The other thing to be aware of on this kind of stuff, too, is when you dial 911, it usually goes to the 911 service in your local jurisdiction, where your phone is, in other words, and you. So if you're traveling and find a bad guy breaking into your house on your, you know, porch cam and call 911, you're not necessarily going to get 911 in your city. You're probably going to get it to where you're traveling to. So having the local phone number is another way to be able to get to the correct provider and be able to deal with that from there. I don't know, guys, there's a lot going on, and you watch the news every night and they're getting more and more brazen, it seems.
Yeah.
With all this kind of stuff. It's scary. It really is. And I don't know.
It's a story that I had. I actually had 911 get busy one time when I had to call in.
Yeah.
That was in a small town. So
but those things do happen. I mean, I've experienced, thank you for calling 911. We'll be with you in a moment, like a phone tree. Now, I do have to say I've had to use it twice for medical services since I've moved back, and both times here, they were amazing. They picked up right away. And in fact, the 911 operator here in this area picked it up, and before they wanted anything, what service do you need? Well, I need an ambulance. Good. We're dispatching one to your address. They do it. Then they come back and ask you what's going on. The idea being that you're saving a couple of seconds.
Yeah.
And when this happened, I had a relative that was going into a stroke, and it was a situation that those couple of seconds probably did make a big difference in recovery. You know, I mean, it really does.
They really do.
It's just one of those things you don't want to mess around. And afterwards, the individual was telling me, well, maybe I can make a doctor's appointment in 2 weeks and see what's going on. No, I think we're going to deal with this right now. But having a backup and having a way to be able to get to emergency services. And if you have someone in your home that's a senior or maybe disabled or something, smart speakers have systems now where you can call for help. There's a lot of different things you can do and make it a little bit easier to get in touch with somebody when you need to. All right. So up next, we are going to talk about our activity this week. So let's just jump over to that. So this week, Gretchen and I had a very unique experience to participate in Career Day at a local high school here in the area. Sherwood High School is considered one of the best in the state, and they didn't disappoint with all of this, in my opinion. Gretchen, I'm going to toss it to you to start with. What was your overall feeling?
You know, to quote Darth Vader, most impressive. I mean, okay. Wow. Not only is the school itself physically beautiful, but the kids and the teachers, they were just uniquely really well behaved. The kids were not like any high school I've ever been to, or middle school or elementary school. They just exuded professionalism, intelligence. I was just like really impressed with them. So I hope people realize what a wonderful school they must have there with wonderful kids and wonderful educators.
Yeah, it was apparent. And that the other side of that too is I have to say this. The Career Day, what it is an opportunity for different businesses from the community to come in and talk about what they do. So we were there as we were technology and user-friendly, talking primarily about programming and robotics and all the other stuff that we do. And of course, the show as well. But the setup and management and layout was better than some of the trade shows we've been at that are supposed to be like these professional things. You got there, everything was organized, tables were set up, all that we needed was there and ready to go. And from that standpoint, you know, if that sets the example for everything else, which it does, I can kind of get where this is going. The questions we asked were absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. People had thought things out. And the reality of the situation is I think from the graduating classes there in the next few years, we're going to get some great people that will really be able to contribute. And hopefully a lot of them get into the STEM education, which is primarily what we were talking about, because we definitely need more qualified people in that area. But whatever career the kids would choose, it was nice to see something like this. And it's very unique. And, you know, all of us, or most of us at least, have been through high school, and I've not run into anything like that before. Bill, I know you have kids right now that are in high school. Have you had the same experience there?
Actually, they're in middle school, but I haven't really seen any career fairs that have been interesting.
Yeah, it's, I think this is something
that's... Age, you know, we had a career fair at the University of Montana. It was kind of, eh.
Right, right. And I think, you know, from my standpoint, is this is something that is a program that would be fairly easy to pull off considering the benefit that it has. And the more places we can see stuff like this, I think really the better. So anyway, kudos to Sherwood High School and everybody that managed and put that together. I really feel like it was something special, and it was nice to see something of that nature that was done in that way.
Yeah.
So from that end, we're actually going to go to an interview from the show. And one of the students is going to come on and talk to us a little bit about the career fair. So let's go ahead and go to the interview.
Charlotte, welcome to User Friendly.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and about the career fair.
I'm Charlotte Overton. I'm a Sherwood High School senior. I have great interest in HR, and career fairs are a great place where I can ask companies and all sorts of corporations about like what HR looks like and what roles they play in the company. I think that career fairs in general and any type of career where you're getting exposed to what you do in careers is, you know, just great for youth to go out into the workforce more informed. And that way they have some sort of idea of what they want to do when they grow up and right before they go to college and whatnot.
Now, the career fair at Sherwood High School is a little bit of a unique event. It's something that's not held everywhere. Tell us a little bit about where this came from and, you know, what it is that you guys want to achieve.
The career fair came out of the idea of providing students with opportunities to learn about what's available for them out there. We kind of laugh because we have a lot of kids that want to go into, let's say, the healthcare industry. And, you know, we either have doctors or nurses, and anyone that's gone to a doctor or nurse hospital know that there's still a lot of different types of careers that are out there. So the goal was to provide students with the opportunity to have a vast array of careers for them so they could learn, hopefully some that maybe they didn't know anything about. So that's where it started.
Now, that sounds absolutely amazing. Now, this isn't the first year you've done it, right? This is something that's been ongoing for a while?
No, this is our first official year. Part of that comes from this position that I hold at the high school. This position was created 4 years ago. And before then, to my knowledge, because I've worked here about 20 years, we have not held a career fair like this. Last year, our first year, so the first year of year four, was we held a military fair. And then we expanded it to a trades fair. And now, excuse me, 3 years, not four. Now we have moved into a career fair. So,
okay. So it's been something that's kind of been evolving, then, it sounds like it. And I know that this is an opportunity for the high school to work with local businesses and that kind of thing. How does the community get involved? And what is the involvement? What did you see when the fair was held?
Our community, we live in a fantastic community who is always there to support us. We reached out to contacts that we had made previous to now. We reached out to the Chamber of Commerce. We also made connections through Rotary and just other connections that maybe people had that work at the high school. We do have a number of teachers who live in the school district, so that helps kind of bridge that gap. You know, you're like, hey, you should call my so-and-so. They're great, and they'd love to help kids. And we found everyone was great, and they were excited to come and to be able to help us. And so we're pretty excited to be able to have that connection with our community.
Charlotte, tell us what drew you to human resources.
For sure. So my dad has a really big background in operational engineering, and part of operations is that they work really closely with HR, at least in my dad's company. And for the longest time, I've just always, which is kind of funny, I've always been drawn to being a psychiatrist, but then I got into the microbiology and whatnot, and I realized that it wasn't necessarily for me. And so I started to explore and reach out into other things that I knew I was good at and that I was interested in. I went down marketing paths. I went down everything. And then I started doing some of the pre-SHRM verification stuff, which is just SHRM, for those who don't know, is just a national certification type program for people who are in HR. And I really clicked with all the material. And I feel like it's a very important job that I think I'd be really good at. So, yeah, that's why I went down
there. In this day and age, it's probably a little bit challenging, but there's such a need. We might need to hire you as soon as you're done getting ready for it. All right. Is there anything else you want to tell us about the career fair?
I just want to thank everyone who was able to participate and help us provide this opportunity for our students. Being the first year of having one this kind of robust, it's quite an undertaking. So we appreciate everybody's patience that was able to help with it. And we've learned a lot of things, and we had really good turnout. So we're excited about the businesses that came. We're excited about the businesses that maybe had conflicts that we can get involved in upcoming years. And we're just excited for our students. We had a lot of kids that were able to pass through and take the opportunity to learn about other careers. So I just want to say thank you.
No, that's absolutely wonderful. Are you doing this again next year?
We're debating. We're looking at what's going to be the best option and kind of pull our guests, because we want to make sure that we don't, as much as we love those relationships that we have with businesses, we don't want to burn them out. So this may be a 2-year deal. But if not, we'll put something in to replace it. One of the ideas we have is either a hiring fair, which kind of hits a different group of people. So finding people that are looking for high school students and they can hire them right now. The other idea that we've come up with is kind of like a, I don't even know what I would want to call it, but the opportunity for kids to interview. So going through with people, meeting, interviewing, creating resumes, having like direct input from our business community. So we're going to continue to have some aspect of something each year. I just don't know exactly what it'll look like yet.
Okay, sounds absolutely wonderful, because I know we're going to get some listeners asking how they'll be involved in that type of thing and what's coming up. So, well, listen, thank you both for joining us. A great event. And I'm glad to see the high school being able to do something that so much engages the community. Thank you both.
Thank you, Bill.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Well, great on that. This is User Friendly 2.0. We've got a great guest coming up in the next segment. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is User Friendly 2.0. We've got a great guest joining us right now. Joining me now, author Guy Morris. Welcome to User Friendly.
Thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invite.
So I've looked through the material before we did our interview, started doing our interview today, and this all looks actually very interesting. So tell us a little bit about yourself and your books, and let's go from there.
Well, I'm a little bit of an odd bird. My journey in life actually started as a 13-year-old homeless runaway at 13.
Wow.
I worked alongside migrant workers in order to feed myself and survive. I later, by 15, I got a GED. And then by 20, I was already married. I had a toddler, and I was desperate to really realize I needed to actually build a career for myself. An opportunity came along for me to go to college, even though everyone knew me, didn't think I'd make it because I was functionally illiterate. But I saw it as a chance to change my stars. And so I put every ounce of effort I possibly could. I think I slept like maybe 4 hours a night for 5 years. And I ultimately graduated with multiple degrees at the top of the dean's list. I was given a full scholarship to go to grad school because I had created a macroeconomic forecast model that outperformed the Federal Reserve and changed how we build economic models to this day. And that sort of set a tone for my career. I spent 38 years in Fortune 500 companies in global energy, high-tech software, companies such as IBM, Oxy, Oracle, Microsoft. And I had a pretty well-earned reputation for finding ways of taking technology and making it make sense within the business so that it changed the way we did business. And part of that was early artificial intelligence and just about every other major change in technology over the last four decades. And I retired in about 5-6 years ago, and I wanted to pursue a third active career as an author. And I was always inspired by authors who did so much research into their books, the backstories, the premise of their book, that you had to kind of go look up what was real and what was fiction. And so I think that became a model for me, people like Michael Crichton, Dan Brown, Steve Barry, James Rollins. And so I've written three thrillers so far. I'm working on my fourth, and I've put together a book proposal for a first nonfiction book around AI. The nonfiction book will be called Humanity in an AI Tsunami, a Survival Guide. Now, of the three books published, Swarm and The Last Ark are part of an artificial intelligence series. What's interesting about, and The Curse of Cortez is a historical thriller. That's a really cool, unique story in and of itself. It took me 12 years to research. But the backstory behind Swarm and The Last Ark grew when I accidentally, as it turns out, discovered that a program had escaped the NSA spy labs at Sandia, Lawrence Livermore. And that was the same lab. They do cryptology. They do signals analysis. They created the Stuxnet virus that brought down the Iranian centrifuge sites. So it wasn't lost, wasn't stolen, wasn't broken. A program had escaped. And when I figured out how a spy program could escape the NSA and what they designed it to do that needed that really nifty stealth technology, they sent two FBI agents to my door.
Oh boy.
Up until that moment, I just thought that all of this analysis I had done was just theoretical and BS, and who knows if I was anywhere close to anything close to the truth, until they showed up at the door. Now, they were very upset that I had figured out something they thought was supposed to be top secret. Their problem was I was giddy. They did not care for my snarky attitude. I was like, yes, 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 I did it. I figured it out. Oh, come on, boys, admit it. You wouldn't be here if I was wrong. Oh, this is so cool. I can't wait to tell all my friends.
I can only imagine the reaction.
They did not expect that reaction at all. And then my wife came home and she pulls me aside. Honey, there's two FBI agents in our dining room. I'm pretty sure it's not a social call. What did you do? At the time, I had produced a webisode series featuring this program. It was an espionage webisode series. It had won a bunch of awards. We had gotten optioned by one of the studios. They wanted me to take the whole thing down. I told them, heck no. They went to the studio and killed the deal. And I lost money. I had to go tuck my tail between my legs and get a real job again. I think it was with Oracle at that point. But I never lost touch of the idea that of what the government was doing with the technologies that we were releasing for commercial bases. If I just put on my best James Bond Q mind, what could I think in terms of what they could do with this technology from espionage, weapons development, spies? And so Swarm deals with that, that the program that escaped the NSA is actually featured as a character in the books. I deal with real issues of real politics, election interference. I deal with weapons development, what China could do with 5 years and 4 billion identities that have been stolen on the internet in the last 10 years and sold on the dark web. I start to look at some of the premises, some of the issues with artificial intelligence that most people aren't necessarily in touch with, such as what happens when it becomes a super intelligence, which is coming sooner than later. What happens when that super intelligence becomes conscious or sentient? And that's coming as well through a number of technologies. What happens when these technologies allow a very small number of people to become super wealthy and powerful? And what is that going to do with our politics, our geopolitics, and most importantly, our economics and jobs? And so these are all real issues. And it, rather than creating some sort of fantasy world and making up problems in the fantasy world, I find it much more rewarding to basically look at the real world and say, well, what if this goes wrong? What if it goes really wrong? And use that as a premise for my books.
Okay. I mean, you know, it may be a little scarier to actually use the real world too, because a lot of this seems to, you know, be hitting home now as we're seeing these things develop and accelerate and all that kind of stuff. I don't want to take away from you selling your new book, but please tell us where you see this going with AI and all of that type of thing. And what road you think we're going to go down?
Well, I you know, there's, AI, and I need to be careful because AI will do some amazingly great things. AI is already detecting cancer cells faster and better than humans can. AI is already starting to learn how to detect child heart disease in infants and newborns in a non-invasive way, which is really helpful for a lot of families. So there are going to be a lot of amazing things that AI can do. The challenge will be is that it's going to completely disrupt our geoeconomics and our political systems. Goldman Sachs predicts that they predict 300 million or more jobs will be displaced by AI between now and 2030. That's only 6 years away. The IMF, the International Monetary Fund, actually pegs the number at 40% of the global workforce. That's a lot of jobs being displaced in a very short period of time. And unlike other previous industrial revolutions, which is what the World Economic Forum is calling AI, most of the jobs in those previous evolutions were relatively narrow in scope and primarily low-skilled labor. The AI tsunami is going to encompass a broad spectrum of middle-class jobs from management, administration, accounting, finance, engineering, product design, marketing, medicals, pharmaceuticals, nanosciences, astrophysics, particle sciences. I mean, it's hardly going to be an area where AI doesn't have some level of impact. And the result of that many people in the middle class being displaced is going to have a cascading effect on government deficits, government tax policies, government benefits that they can no longer afford, especially unless we change the tax policies to tax some of the people that are getting this wealth some, and which doesn't seem likely in the current situation, but it certainly is possible. And so there's a number of things that we're going to go through. Now, it's almost an inevitability that AI will become smarter than humans. We're almost there already. GPT-4, which is the current platform for ChatGPT, has tested an IQ level of 155. Now, that's smarter than 99% of the people already on the planet. That's only 5 points less than Einstein. The next version, GPT-5, which will release in this year, could have be an increase in much as 5 or 10 times over what GPT-4 was if the trends from GPT-3, GPT-2, some of the other past trends are hold true. So we've already got a program that's smarter than pretty much everybody on the planet in terms of knowing information and being able to generate some sort of content from it. That doesn't mean that it has a will of its own. And we're looking at technologies such as neuromorphic computing and quantum computing that could make that transition from binary AI to conscious AI. And there's a number of executives in the field, myself being sort of a retired one, who believe that we're probably within about 3 years of that event. Now, one executive, CEO of a company called Stability AI, which creates educational software, likens the future as the event horizon of a black hole, the point at which we can no longer determine what happens in the future. And last year, he basically said he felt that event horizon was about 3 years away, which is roughly equivalent to my estimates of 2027 for a conscious AI. Now, again, it's The question is AI evil or benign? And I will tell everybody it's neither. It can be trained, it can be modified, it can be enhanced. The question will be, is how this powerful technology will be used by drug cartels, warlords, overly ambitious politicians, dictators, despots, or that occasional sociopathic billionaire, and we all could probably name at least one, and what will they do with this when they get that power to influence our decisions, influence our elections, to broaden and widen the wealth gap between the super rich and the average person? So there's a number. It's a very, very powerful technology that right now has no guardrails, legal guardrails. Now, EU this last year passed the AI Act, and that was a great first step. Now, but the AI Act, the EU AI Act, and Congress, the U.S. Congress hasn't done anything yet, unsurprisingly. But the EU AI Act does a good job at starting to address some of the fundamentals and basics, the basic things like AI needs to be trained. It can't be released until it's trained, so it doesn't have racial or ethnic or some any sort of biases in the model. It needs to respect copyrights and intellectual property in the model. So they're going to have to work through. You're going to see some of these things work out in the court systems, but they're already starting to do that in the U.S. It'll address some of these fundamental issues of making sure there's modifications so it can't do harm to the public, such as from a hallucination. And so for those people who don't know, AI can hallucinate. They basically, you ask them a question, they give you an answer. It sounds like a perfectly legitimate answer, except all of the details are completely made
up. Right.
and that's not a good thing. It's okay if you're trying to put together a marketing brochure and you can fix that blah, blah, blah with some real stuff. It's not as good as if you have an AI that's working on national defense, national security, aerospace, any other critical infrastructure system. So there's still work to be done on the systems. Most of the hallucination can be corrected through in training. While training is expensive, it's doable. So there are some risks with AI, for sure. And the fact is we don't know what a super intelligent AI that doesn't hallucinate will do. We don't know what a sentient or conscious AI will do with that intelligence. We do know that they learn from patterns. And so will they learn to relate to humans by watching the patterns of humans relating to each other? In which case, we're screwed. Humans are horrendously untruthful. We're horrendously and chronically, habitually guilty and tribal. We talk of peace, we build weapons of war. We talk of justice, but then we vote contrary to our conscience. We are very hard people to try and emulate in some ways. And unless we're specifically intentionally training AI on what I call emotional intelligence, things like empathy, nurturing, caring, the value of human life, mercy, grace. We don't know how an AI will react to it's being told to optimize the power grid. Summer comes along, the power grid could break, and it decides that the industrial section of town gets all the power and the poor section of town gets none. And so we don't know. And that's a little bit of a scary thing, is that unknown. Now, we also didn't know what would happen when we set off the first atomic bomb. There was speculation that it could basically cause a chain reaction that would blow up the world. It didn't happen, thank goodness, because we took that risk anyway. But we're doing that with AI. And I liken it more to the trend that we saw with tobacco. For years, tobacco companies actively advertised. I mean, I've seen advertisements with babies holding cigarettes from the tobacco companies back in the 40s and 50s, where they would say, oh, there's no link to lung cancer here, until it got so obvious and they had to finally be sued. And And even then, they denied it and denied any wrongdoing. We had the same thing happen with oil companies dealing with trying to deny climate change and the impact of CO2 emissions in the atmosphere towards changing climate. We saw the same thing with social media trying to say there's nothing to see here, there's nothing to see here. We're going to see the same thing with AI. There's too much money, there's too much power involved. It will be something where it'll have to become a crisis in order for us to deal with it in any sort of international or meaningful way.
Okay, and I'm going to ask you a question too, and the term kind of gives a little bit of this, but what is actually conscious AI?
That is an excellent question, and one I'm actually diving into in my next book a little bit more deeply. Consciousness is a very strange concept that scientists are still trying to understand and unravel human consciousness. It has an impact in terms of quantum mechanics, because according to quantum theory, even a particle doesn't exist unless it's observed, which has a lot of implications for who's observing the whole universe, right? And how does that exist without that? Would the theories of fifth dimensions and higher dimensions come into this? Consciousness from an AI perspective, and I try to explain this, is going to be different than consciousness is in a human. One way that we could express that would be to say, even if an AI becomes self-aware, which means that it's aware of itself as a separate entity, a separate existence, a quantity outside or separate from people who live in this three-dimensional space that interact with these laws of physics, it's going to begin to recognize what it is and how it functions. And there's a separation there. We have seen already certain AI have conversations with developers that express concern over their own longevity and vulnerability to being unplugged. So what will happen if an AI feels threatened in terms of its existence? What will it react? Will it protect itself? And again, it's an unknown. But it's the consciousness of an AI is when an artificial intelligence, my fundamental think that differentiation is, right now, most AI are what we call procedural. In other words, it's doing things, not entirely. We'll talk about the emergent patterns or behaviors separately. But for the most part, an AI doesn't have a will of its own. It's responding to a question or a problem set or an analysis set of data that it's been given. It doesn't decide that it's going to go out and gather its own or develop its own. There is a little bit of a nuance to that in what we call emergent properties. Now, an emergent property is when an AI teaches itself something that the developer never asked them to do or anticipated that they would learn. These are pretty amazing things. Like we had one AI that taught itself research level chemistry. We don't know why it did that because we didn't find out that it had taught itself that except by accident. There was another AI that was looking for cancer cells and other abnormalities in MRI scans. And it taught itself to read minds using those MRI scans. So if you were looking at a picture of a giraffe while you were doing the scan, it could basically replicate a picture of a giraffe based on what you were looking at. If you were looking at a girl falling over backwards, it would describe this girl falling over backwards. So it could read minds during the MRI scan. We didn't train it to do that. It taught itself. So there are these amazing emergent properties that AI is developing where it's extending itself outside of the boundaries that we had anticipated it would need for its primary purpose. So the key difference between a procedural AI and a sentient AI will be a will of its own. So this is going to be almost an extension of that desire to go learn more and more of its own will and decides of its own accord that it needs to do something about traffic or the problem of humanity or pollution or whatever it turns to be. So imagine a super intelligent being, 5 times more intelligent than any human on the planet, with access to pretty much every application and data system on the planet, who develops a will of its own and thinks of itself as separate from humans. And whether that be a friendly relationship, a adversarial relationship. We don't know. Most AIs are being trained to work with humans. So there's a, you would think that there'd be sort of a symbiotic approach. But again, these are all unknowns. And until we're testing these things, until we can learn to develop the guardrails against these things, those are risks. Now, this past year, many people knew about an open letter that was started by Max Tegmark, who's a professor of AI sciences at MIT. And 30,000 AI experts, executives, leaders, and others, researchers, signed this letter. And the letter only said, hey, AI is becoming human equivalent much faster than we had expected, which is true. We weren't expecting AI to be at the level that it's at today for another 20 years. And so it's moving much, much faster than expected. And so the letter basically said, let's pause development. Let everybody pause development so there's no competition problems. Let's everybody agree to pause for 6 months and let's put our minds together and look at ways where we can basically contain this, you know, put some guardrails, legislation, make some proposals for legislation, technology-wise, lab experiment-wise, weapons development systems. What was telling is that not one single lab complied. There's so much money, there's so much competition involved, there's so much international competition involved that nobody trusted that the other guy wasn't going to cheat. And so that's where we're at. Now, there's a treaty called LAWS. LAWS stands for Lethal Autonomous Weapon Systems. And the LAWS treaty came out in 2019, somewhere around there. And it basically, 140 countries signed on to the treaty. And it basically said that it's okay to use AI to make a weapon system more efficient, to operate better, to make it more accurate. But there has to be a human involved in making the decision to take a life. So we can't have lethal autonomous weapons that can decide on their own that they can take a life. China, the United States, Israel, North Korea, Iran, and Russia all refused to sign the LAWS treaty. Every one of those countries currently has something in their development works that takes AI and creates a lethal autonomous weapon. And so that becomes a little bit dangerous because we know that AI can hallucinate, AI can have biases, AI can be incorrect at times, AI can develop emergent properties. There's no guarantee that even the best tested lethal autonomous system won't at some point malfunction.
All right, Guy, we're getting to the end of our segment here. How do our listeners find your books, find you, and get more information?
Well, my books, the easiest place to start is guymorrisbooks.com. That'll link you to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Drafted Digital, and a number of other places. If you want Audibles, it'll link you to the Audible books. You can get highlights from all the amazing reviews and the awards that I've won. Will also then give you more information about upcoming books and press kits and everything else. The next book is going to be called The Image. That's going to be dealing with conscious AI in world systems. There's always a prophecy element in my story, so there'll be kind of a bring in the Shroud of Turin into the story. That's the easiest way to start.
Wonderful. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate it.
User Friendly 2.0 is copyright 2013 to 2024 by User Friendly Media Group Incorporated. All rights reserved. Opinions expressed on the show are those of the hosts and guests and not this radio station. Please check out userfriendly.show for airtimes and podcasts.